Okay, thank you very much for inviting me. After all these wonderful results, but a little technical, maybe it's the right time to have a lighter presentation on something which is quite naive from certain points of view. This is not really my main research field at the moment, and a part of the result that I am going to present here have been obtained, I'm afraid to say, almost 25 years ago. But there have been a nice revival recently. So I'm going to skip the introduction because although we want to have dinner tonight. So of course everybody knows that you have had different models of light, wave versus particle, with the famous conflict between Newton and Huygens, and the triumph of waves in the 19th century with really great genius, Jung, Fresnel, who established the fact that light is a wave without knowing the nature of the wave. And then after the work of Maxwell, we know that we have electromagnetic waves, and at the end of it, according to Lord Kelvin, you know his statement, physics is finished except for two small details which will give quantum mechanics and relativity. So, which means that Kelvin was smart, by the way, because he pointed out the correct points which were interesting. Everybody knows that a major contribution of Einstein in 1905 was to introduce the concept of light quantum. It was named photon only much later, which is quantum of energy and quantum of momentum. He made quantitative prediction for the photoelectric effect. Nobody believed him, and Millikan endeavored to demonstrate that Einstein's prediction on the photoelectric effect were wrong, and he demonstrated that they were correct. And if you don't believe me, just read the Review of Modern Physics paper by Millikan. He explicitly says that he entered in this domain to prove that Einstein's law of the photoelectric effect was wrong. And the result of that is that Einstein was awarded the Nobel Prize explicitly for the photoelectric effect. Of course, everybody knows he deserved it for other subjects, but it's interesting to notice that the Nobel Committee spotted the photoelectric effect. And now we have a big problem, because we had the genius of the 19th century, Fresnel, Jung, Maxwell and company, who tells us clearly that light is a wave, and now we have Einstein telling us that it is a photon. And so is it a particle? Is it a wave? Einstein addressed this question as early as 1909. There is a famous Salzburg conference where he comes, by many different arguments, to the conclusion that light is both a wave and a particle. And I insist it was 1909. For instance, he is able to make a calculation of the fluctuation of blackbody radiation and finds that in this fluctuation you have two terms. This term is a term corresponding to an assembly of particles at random, and this term comes from the bit notes between waves with random mutual phases. And because you have the sum of the two terms, Einstein concludes that light is both a wave and a particle, because you have this term corresponding to particles, this term corresponding to waves. It's amazing. Of course, we know that De Broglie made the assumption that the reciprocal is true, that when we have a particle, it also behaves as a wave. And so the solution is very simple, according to textbook. It's called wave-particle duality. And the words are easy to say, but it's more difficult to understand the concepts and to represent it by something palatable. So let us go to textbooks, for instance, Feynman. What do they tell us? They tell us that in principle you should be able to make an experiment in which you have particles emitted one after the other one all the time in the same state, and if you have two holes here, a detector, and you scan the detector, you are going to observe interference fringes. And if you close one detector, then no interference. And so the conclusion is that even when you have a single particle, it behaves as a wave which passes simultaneously through the two holes which are here. Okay, so far so good. Everybody understand that. Now, the question is, this is a textbook experiment. Has this been observed in real experiments? And probably you have heard about feeble light interference experiments. What do they mean? We asked this question more than 25 years ago with Philippe Grangier, and first we did our homework. We looked at many different experiments, and the basic idea of all these experiments is the following. You take a system in which you observe, let's say, interference or diffraction, and then you attenuate light so much that in the average, one photon and the next photons are separated by a distance much larger than the size of the apparatus. Okay? And so, if the phenomenon of interference of diffraction survives, then people come to the conclusion that they have observed single particle wave effect. Well, in 1980, when I started visiting this problem, we had learned many things from Glauber, and in particular the fact that an attenuated beam of light is certainly not a beam you would like to describe by a Fock state with n equal 1, a single photon state. We all know that it should be described as a coherent state, a quasi-classical state. And if it is very much attenuated, it means that the quantity alpha, the parameter alpha of the coherent state, is very small compared to 1. But in any case, what we have learned from Glauber is that when we have a coherent state, whatever the amplitude of alpha, it will always behave exactly as a classical wave. It can be demonstrated easily. Okay. How can we know? So let us suppose we ask ourselves the question, does a beam behave like single particle? What experiment should we do? Coming again to this textbook experiment, we could consider the following experiment. Put a detector behind the first hole, a detector behind the second hole. Here you are going to have a certain rate of detection, and you look at detection in coincidence, joint detection. If you have really one particle at a time, you are not going to observe a joint detection, and the probability of joint detection is going to be zero. Okay? So, if you want to demonstrate that you have single particles, you are going to do this experiment, and you must observe a probability of joint detection equals zero. So, because of course a single particle, this of course can be worked out in the formalism of quantum optics, but also it fits to the naive idea that a single particle cannot be split. Okay? But of course, if you have a wave, you are going to have a wavelet here, a wavelet there, and a certain probability of detection in coincidence. So this experiment, this which path experiment, is able to tell us either if you have a single particle, a beam made of single particle, or a beam behaving just like a wave. Surprisingly enough, this experiment had never been done by anybody before we did our experiment in 1985. And if you try to understand why, it's because people who consider this problem, either they worked with electrons, neutron, atom, molecules, and then they know they are particles, they don't feel compelled to prove that they are particles. And in the case of faint light, people really thought that if the average rate of photons in the beam is small enough, if the average distance between two photons is much larger than the size of the apparatus, you don't need to demonstrate that you have single particles. But I have shown you a little too early, I have shuffled a little bit my transparency, that Glauber told us the opposite. So we slightly modified the idea, and we thought with Grangier that by using a beam splitter here, we could really do this experiment. If we have a single photon, it will go either on that side or on the other side of the beam splitter, and you expect no coincidence between these two detectors. In the opposite, if you have a wave, it is split in two, and then you are going to have a certain probability of joint detection. And this certain probability of joint detection, actually, we can put a minimum on it. And the reasoning is quite easy. If you have waves, the probability of joint detection is proportional to the square of the intensity of the wave, okay? But the single rates, here or here, are each proportional to the intensity. And of course, everybody knows this Cauchy-Schwarz inequality. The average of the square is larger than or equal to the square of the average, which means that if you have a wave, you are sure that the probability of joint detection will always be equal or larger to the product P1, P2. So now we have a quantity alpha, which is predicted to be bigger than 1 if you have a wave. But if you have a particle, you predict that Pc equals 0. But of course, for an experimentalist, 0 means nothing. And this is why we developed an inequality like that, because even taking into account dark counts and stuff like that, if we have a quantity alpha which is smaller than 1, it means that it cannot be a wave. It has to be described as a stream of particles. So this is a criterion we established to prove that we have single particles. And the first thing we did was taking a classical source, LED, emitting pulses with a duration of 5 nanoseconds, and attenuating it to a level of 10 to the minus 2 photon per pulse. It's very easy. You measure how much you have in each pulse, and you put enough of neutral density in front of it. So when you have 10 to the minus 2 photon per pulse, of course, you don't detect often. But sometimes you detect something here, sometimes you detect something there, but sometimes there is also something detected in coincidence. And when we calculated the quantity alpha, we exactly found, well, we found 1. Which means that Glauber was right. Whatever you attenuate a classical beam, at the end, you have something behaving exactly like a wave. If you insist for understanding this with an image of photon, what happens? Well, we all know that in a quasi-classical state, we have a Poisson distribution. And the Poisson distribution we have here means probability to have 0 is very close to 1. Probability to have 1 photon is peanut, but the probability to have 2 photons is peanut to the square. And it's you have just enough of pairs that sometimes the pair arrives, one photon goes on one side of the beam splitter, the other one goes on the other side, and then at the end of the day you have alpha equals 1. Okay, so that's the end of the experiment with feeble light. Because feeble light is not single photon, so it doesn't prove anything about wave-particle duality. So let us try to do single photon experiments. And of course nowadays everybody understands that to have single photon, you just take a single emitter, you excite it, it emits a single photon. But at that time, 25 years ago, nobody had ever seen that yet. And the only sources we had were sources with zillions of molecules or atoms and something like that, and then what you get is always Poisson or super Poisson light. And then pioneers introduced the idea that in order to produce single photons or non-classical light, what you must do is isolate single emitters. So Kimball, Dagenais, and Mandel, in their famous anti-bunching experiments, took a very dilute atomic beam, a microscope, and looked into a volume where most of the time there is one and only one atom emitting. And they could show, and this was a famous anti-bunching experiment, that when you have only one atom emitting, just after emitting a first photon, the probability to get a second one doesn't happen before a certain delay, and there is a violation of a Cauchy-Schwarz inequality, which is not at all the one I have shown here. Okay? And there is an experiment of Clauser in 1974, where he demonstrated also a violation of a quite involved in Cauchy-Schwarz inequality. What he had was a source with many cascades, but by doing correlation between the atoms, he was able to isolate single atom effect, and on isolating single atom effect, he could show that he was violating some kind of classical Cauchy-Schwarz inequalities. So inspired by this experiment of Kimball, Dagenais, and Mandel, who had been able to isolate single atoms in space, we could do an experiment in which, instead of isolating single atom in space, we isolated on the time axis. The idea is the following. I have developed a source of pairs of correlated photons for testing Bell's inequality. And basically, it consisted of exciting many calcium atoms to the upper state, and you have a cascade with a green photon and a violet photon separate with a distribution with a lifetime here of 5 nanoseconds. And the rate of, so you have zillions of atoms emitting simultaneously, and the rate of cascades here is about 10 to the 7th per second, which means in the average, you have 100 nanoseconds between one pair and the next pair. So you have green-violet, then nothing. Green-violet, nothing. So the idea is to isolate these events on the time axis. So when I detect the green photon, I open a gate, look for the next 5 nanoseconds, and close the gate. During these 5 nanoseconds, I'm sure to observe single atoms effect. And we measure the parameter alpha, and we obtain something which is clearly less than one. It's not zero, of course, because of dark counts and usual stuff. So now we have particle-like behavior, and we have been able to produce single photons. This is a modern version of it. It has been done at École Normale Supérieure de Cachan by Jean-François Roch and his team. And everybody knows that you can address a molecule here. It's in a confocal microscope. You excite it and you observe single photon emission and you observe alpha clearly less than one. Okay, now we have a source producing single photons. And with this source, we can revisit the equation of interference experiment. So we take our source, send it on a beam splitter, we combine the beams. We did this experiment. Basically, it was a thesis of Philippe Grangier long ago. And you see that if you are patient enough, you observe a wonderful visibility for the fringes. And this is done in the single photon regime, in the regime, really, where we have single photons. I can show you. If you give me an extra 5 minutes, he cannot say no, okay? I can show you how this has been implemented recently, well, a few years ago, in Cachan. The interferometer is Fresnel biprism. You have a beam, you have the beam of single photon, and you spread it and put it on two prisms. This prism sends the beam down, and this prism steers the beams up, okay? And now you have a detector here and a detector there, and you look at the correlation, at the probability of joint detection between here and there, and again, alpha is less than one, which means that the photon either passes up or passes down, okay? This is the image. Now, you put a CCD camera here in the overlap of the two beams, and if it was a wave, you would have an interference, okay? It's a Fresnel biprism system. And so this observation in the overlap, does it show in different fringes? And this is a new computer, so I hope it's going to work. Now it will work. Ah, two times. I shouldn't. Okay, once is enough. So you understand what you have here? What you have here is a CCD, which is here. So each time a photon is arriving, we are going to see a bright spot. So let's run it. No, not yet. Doesn't want. Now, you see the spots arriving. And here on this axis, we accumulate the number of dots along vertical lines. And you see this single photon interference experiment. This true single photon interference experiment, okay? It's not a laser beam which is attenuated. This is done with the source of single photons. And so this is a wonderful example you can show to your students. And I have the reference of the site where you can download it. This is real single photon interference experiment. Okay. So far, so good. We have demonstrated unambiguously wave-like behavior in the single photon regime. Let us look at it carefully. In the first experiment, we detect either here or there, never on both sides. It means that the photon arrives here and either goes here or goes there. In the second experiment, it's the same light beam, the same source, and now I have an interference, which means that something that we call a wave, it's split in two and recombined. But again, it's the same single photon wave packets. We have not changed anything here. How can it work? Of course, when you have a problem in quantum mechanics, a conceptual problem in quantum mechanics, you look into Niels Bohr. And Bohr comes and tells you the two experiments are incompatible. You have to choose. Either you do this experiment or you do the other one. You cannot put one on top of the other one. And Bohr would elaborate probably on the fact that the result that you get depends on the type of apparatus you are using. So, the question you ask, could it be that the photon behaves differently when it sees this apparatus or when it sees that apparatus? The photon arrives here and say, ah, they're asking me if I am a particle. So, I take my particle-like behavior. And then, when the photon arrives here, you say, haha, I know this one is an interferometer. I know I need to behave like a wave. Well, it looks funny, but in a sense, Bohr insists that the behavior depends on the kind of apparatus you are using. And so Mr. Wheeler, who was quite smart, asked the question, what would happen if the quasar were chosen after the passage of the input beam splitter? And this is the idea of Wheeler's delay choice experiment. So how can we do Wheeler's delay choice experiment? We want to choose between this scheme and that scheme after the photon passes a beam splitter. It's very easy. You slightly change the scheme. You agree that this scheme is equivalent to the previous one because here there is nothing, okay? So if the photon goes here, it's detected here. If it goes there, it's detected there. And now to go from this apparatus to that apparatus, you have just to put in or put out the beam splitter. Okay? So you can choose a equation by changing the beam splitter, and you can make the choice after the photon passes here. This was the view of Wheeler, and you see that what I present is almost the same. The experiment has been done by Jean-François Roch and his team in Cachan. So you have the single photon source. You have an interferometer with the length of about 50 meters, And here, you have a system with an electro-optic modulator, etc. I can tell you how it works, but you understand easily. And depending whether you apply or you do not apply a voltage here, either the beam splitter is in or it is out. And the choice of putting the beam splitter in or out is done about when the photon is about in the middle here. After after traveling 20 meters or 25 meters in the interferometer, then the choice is done. So in other words, the choice of introducing or not introducing the beam splitter here is clearly space-like separated from the entrance of the photon here. Okay, so what do? They do the experiment. They look at what they record here and there, and there is a way to change the path difference in the interferometer. And they sort out the events when the beam splitter were in and the events when the beam splitter was not in. So these are the results when the beam splitter was in, and of course you see a beautiful visibility of 94% on a 50 meter long interferometer. This is a real tour de force. And you have a wave-like behavior. And if you look at the result when the beam splitter was not there, there is no modulation visible. This experiment again is done in the single photon regime. And they did an extra test. If you introduce, if you block this path here, clearly you detect only here. You have a which way parameter, and you do the other experiment to show that clearly you can tell where the photon goes. So the photon travels one route or the other, and we can tell which one. The choice is made by a quantum random noise generator, and it's separated by a space-like interval from passage of the first beam splitter. And the only conclusion I can give is to cite John Wheeler. Thus, one decides the photon shall have come by one route or by both routes after it has already done its travel. That's the only reasonable conclusion you can make when you look at these results. Okay? So it's yet more quantum weirdness. And in 1 minute, everybody knows that this is a fascinating subject. What can we say? Well, if you talk to your students, you should insist that quantum optics formalism gives a current account of everything. And not only when you talk to your students, when you talk to journalists. Otherwise, journalists are puzzled. They say you are not serious. Either you take the wave picture or you take the particle picture. So you have to tell them that the mathematics do not have to choose. It's a single mathematical tool that describes everything. Both complementarity can soothe us a little bit, but the delayed choice experiment shows that complementarity should not be interpreted in a too naive way. It's more subtle than saying that the behavior depends on the apparatus and thinking of a kind of mechanical interaction. But of course, we know that questioning the foundation of quantum mechanics is not only an academic issue. Clarifying the basic concepts of quantum physics has led to several applications, and in particular to quantum cryptography in the Bennett and Brassard scheme. Bonjour Gilles. So this is one of the many examples of people doing quantum cryptography. And to conclude, I would like to show you two citations of Feynman, which I think are quite interesting from an historical perspective. In the early 60s or late 50s, in the lecture of physics, Feynman wrote about wave-particle duality. It has in it the heart of quantum mechanics. In reality, it contains the only mystery. So wave-particle duality is really the big example of quantum weirdness. But 20 years later, Feynman came with a paper, a famous paper, It is a paper that everybody cites because it is a founding paper on quantum computing. But read carefully that paper. There is a full section about Bell's inequality without citing Bell. But it's Feynman's inequality. But the point is that Feynman comes with his inequality to showing that entanglement is something else which can be used for quantum computing. And this citation is, I think, very interesting. It seems to be almost ridiculous that you can squeeze the difficulty of quantum mechanics, okay? That you can squeeze it to a numerical equation that one thing is bigger than another one, but there you are, it is bigger than any logical argument can produce. So I think that when you look at that, and it's amazing from the present perspective, that visiting these two equations, which were conceptual equations, wave particle duality and entanglement, Bell's inequality violation, now we have all these applications in quantum information. And so to conclude, I want to show you the team who has done the experiment. Again, I'm not directly involved in these experiments nowadays. So the team is headed by Jean-François Roch. The most important people, as usual, are the PhD student, Yi Wu. Yi is a real Chinese first name. I think there are people who can confirm that here. And Vincent Jacques and several people. But what I like very much in this image is the following. Because behind the scene, you have the godfather of the experiment. And the interesting thing is the following. Philippe Grangier was my first PhD student. Jean-François Roch was the first PhD student of Philippe Grangier. And Vincent Jacques is the first PhD student of Jean-François Roch. So it's a long family story. Thank you very much.
Thank you for an excellent talk. Could there possibly be questions? Indeed. Cool.
1.4 cents in response to the delayed choices.
I think that Bohr was smart enough that he did not think that the equation is a equation of mechanical perturbation of the system by the measurement. It's clear that when you read Bohr, it's not clear, okay? Bohr said once that clarity and truth are complementary observables. And he made, not this true, and he made all efforts to be true. But anyway, when you read carefully Bohr, it's clear that he did not have a naive view of complementarity. And he certainly did not have the naive view of, for instance, the Heisenberg microscope that we have sometimes in elementary courses. You know, you have real mechanical disturbance of the system. Bohr realized that it was more abstract. So nobody can speak for Bohr, but I think that Bohr would have just stayed on his position and say that you cannot use images coming from our everyday life. I think that is a conclusion. But the remarkable point, and which was realized only like 20 years ago, is that these non-classical properties that you have in quantum mechanics can be used to go beyond classical information processing, for instance. So it's a BB84 or the Eckert scheme for cryptography or quantum computing. And I think it took a long time to realize that there is a statement by one famous, he was working in the Bell Labs, in IBM, Landauer. Yes. A statement of Landauer saying information is physical. So when you have to face the fact that the laws of physics are different, and this is what is shown by these violations of inequality, then you can expect to have a different way of processing information. And nowadays it's easy to say it, but 25 years ago, nobody had this idea. Only pioneers began to think about it. Oh, yes.
What's interesting then is, of course, you lose inference.
Yes.
And then you can derive inequality that relates those two experiments. So now you have a single inequality which contains both the numbers you measure in the Goldstein experiment and also the visibility.
Yes. Sure. It's slightly different. Well, this is a very good statement, a very good remark. But along this spirit, of course, when we do these presentations, and especially when we do it to a more general public than the public that we have nowadays, okay, like first-year students or something like that, you always present things like white or black, okay, it's a wave or a particle. But you are perfectly right that you can have intermediate stage. And for instance, there is a variation, this experiment, in which the second beam splitter is not 50%, 50%. Let's suppose it's 80%, 20%. So then, according to the side where you detect the photon, you can make a good guess of where the photon came from. And so we have been able to write exactly what you say, that is to say, to have an experiment in which we have interference with the visibility which is less than one, and in which we can tell with a reasonable level of confidence that the photon passed through one or the other path, and there is an inequality, Zurek for instance, derived one, and there is a kind of inequality in which you have the square of the visibility plus the square of the which path parameter, something which tells if the photon was on one side or the other one, which has to be smaller than or equal to one. Which means that if you can tell with certainty that the photon went on one side or the other one, then the visibility is zero. But if you accept a certain level of confidence, then you don't spoil totally the fringes. So this reference, okay? Dirichlet's test of quantum complementarity with interfering single photons. And the experiment I have presented today is this one. It was published in Science in 2007. And the old experiment was this one, 86. Well, by the way, if you are amused by these things, you can look in this paper. This is a paper where we did an experiment in which we had a single photon emitted by two atoms flying in opposite directions. That was amusing, so.
Well, I think with that, we should take the opportunity to thank both Alain and all of today's speakers, and then retire next door, I believe, Daniel, that it's next door to a reception which will be very conducive to discussing more properties of quantum weirdness. Please join me. Thank you.